Disc 10.
On November 10th, 3 days before the expiration of the continuing resolution, Congress sent me a new one that threw down the gauntlet. The price for keeping the government open was signing a new CR that increased Medicare premiums 25%, cut funding for education and the environment, and weakened environmental laws. The following day, just a week after Rabin's assassination, I gave my radio address on the Republican attempts to pass their budget through the back door of the CR. It was Veterans Day, so I pointed out that 8 million of the seniors whose Medicare premiums would be raised were veterans. There was no need for the GOP's draconian cuts. The combined rates of unemployment and inflation were at a 25-year low. Federal employment as a percentage of the overall workforce was the smallest since 1933, and the deficit was down. I still wanted to balance the budget, but in a way that was consistent with our fundamental values and without threats and without partisan rancor. On Monday night, the Congress finally sent me an extension of the debt limit. It was worse than the CR, another backdoor effort to pass the budget cuts and weaken environmental laws. The legislation also stripped from the Secretary of the Treasury the fund management flexibility he had had since the Reagan years to avoid defaults under extraordinary circumstances. Even worse, it lowered the debt limit again after 30 days, virtually ensuring a default. Gingrich had been threatening since April to shut the government down and put America in default if I didn't accept his budget. I couldn't tell whether he really wanted to do it, or whether he simply believed all the press coverage during my first 2 years that, in the face of ample evidence to the contrary, had portrayed me as too weak, too willing to abandon commitments, too eager to compromise. If so, he should have paid more attention to the evidence. On November 13th, with the existing CR scheduled to expire at midnight, the negotiators met one more time to try to resolve our differences before the government shutdown. Dole, Gingrich, Army, Daschle, and Gephardt were there, as were Al Gore, Leon Panetta, Bob Rubin, Laura Tyson, and other members of our team. The atmosphere was already tense when Gingrich started the meeting by complaining about our TV ads. We had started running ads in targeted states in June to highlight administration achievements, beginning with the crime bill. When the budget debate heated up after Labor Day, we put up new ads targeting the proposed Republican cuts, especially in Medicare and Medicaid. After Newt carried on for a while, Leon Panetta tersely reminded him of all the terrible things he had said about me before the 1994 election. "Mr. Speaker, you don't have clean hands." Dole tried to calm things, saying that he didn't want the government to shut down. At that point, Dick Armey broke in to say Dole didn't speak for the House Republicans. Armey was a big man who always wore cowboy boots and seemed to be in a constant state of agitation. He launched into a tirade about how the House Republicans were determined to be true to their principles and how angry he was that my TV ads on the Medicare cuts had frightened his elderly mother-in-law. I replied that I didn't know about his mother-in-law, but if the Republican budget cuts were to become law, large numbers of elderly people would be forced out of nursing homes or lose their home health care. Armey replied gruffly that if I didn't give in to them, they would shut the government down and my presidency would be over. I shot back, saying I would never allow their budget to become law, even if I dropped to 5% in the polls. If you want your budget, you'll have to get someone else to sit in this chair. Not surprisingly, we didn't make a deal. After the meeting, Daschle, Gephardt, and my team were elated by my confrontation with Armey. Al Gore said he wished everyone in America had heard my declaration, except I should have said I didn't care if it fell to zero in the polls. I looked back at him and said, "No, Al, if we drop to 4%, I'm caving." We all laughed, but our insides were still in knots. I vetoed both the CR and the debt ceiling bill, and the next day at noon, large portions of the federal government shut down. Almost 800,000 workers were sent home, disrupting the lives of millions of Americans who needed their applications for Social Security, veterans benefits, and business loans processed, their workplaces inspected for safety, their national parks opened for visits, and much more. After the vetoes, Bob Rubin took the unusual step of borrowing $61 billion from retirement funds to pay our debt and avert default for a while longer. Not surprisingly, the Republicans tried to blame me for the shutdown. I was afraid they'd get away with it, given their success at blaming me for the partisan divide in the 94 election. Then I got a break when, at a breakfast with reporters on the 15th, Gingrich implied that he had made the CR even harsher because I'd snubbed him during the flight back from Rabin's funeral by not talking to him about the budget and asking him to leave the plane by the back ramp instead of the front one with me. Gingrich said, "It's petty, but I think it's human. Nobody has talked to you and they ask you to get off the plane by the back ramp. You just wonder where's their sense of manners." Perhaps I should have discussed the budget on the way home, but I couldn't bring myself to think about anything but the purpose of the sad trip and the future of the peace process. I did visit with the speaker and the congressional delegation, as a photograph of Newt, Bob Dole, and me talking on the plane showed. As for getting off the back of the plane, my staff thought they were being courteous because that was the exit closest to the cars that were picking up Gingrich and the others. And it was 4:30 in the morning. There were no cameras around. The White House released the photo of our conversation, and the press lampooned Gingrich's complaints. On the 16th, at a news conference, I continued to ask the Republicans to send me a clean CR and to begin good-faith budget negotiations, even as they threatened to send me another one with all the same problems. The night before, I signed the Department of Transportation Appropriations Bill, only the fourth of the needed 13, and canceled my scheduled trip to the Asia-Pacific Leaders Meeting in Osaka, Japan. On November 19th, I made a move toward the Republicans, saying that, in principle, I would work for a 7-year balanced budget agreement, but would not commit to the GOP tax and spending cuts. The economy had continued to grow, with the deficit dropping more than expected. Panetta, Alice Rivlin, and our economics team believed we could now get to balance in 7 years without the harsh cuts the Republicans were pushing. I signed two more appropriations bills for the legislative branch and for the Treasury Department, the Postal Service, and general government operations. With 6 of the 13 bills signed, about 200,000 of the 800,000 federal employees were back at work. On the morning of November 21st, Warren Christopher called me from Dayton to say that the presidents of Bosnia, Croatia, and Serbia had reached a peace agreement to end the war in Bosnia. The agreement preserved Bosnia as a single state to be made up of two parts, the Bosnian Croat Federation and the Bosnian Serb Republic, with a resolution of territorial disputes over which the war was begun. Sarajevo would remain the undivided capital city. The national government would have responsibility for foreign affairs, trade, immigration, citizenship, and monetary policy. Each of the federations would have its own police force. Refugees would be able to return home, and free movement throughout the country would be guaranteed. There would be international supervision of human rights and police training, and those charged with war crimes would be excluded from political life. A strong international force commanded by NATO would supervise the separation of forces and keep the peace as the agreement was being implemented. The Bosnian peace plan was hard won, and its particulars contained bitter pills for both sides, but it would bring an end to 4 bloody years that claimed more than 250,000 lives and caused more than 2 million people to flee their homes. American leadership was decisive in pushing NATO to be more aggressive and in taking the final diplomatic initiative. Our efforts were immeasurably helped by the Croatian and Bosnian military gains on the ground and the brave and stubborn refusal of Izetbegovic and his comrades to give up in the face of Bosnian Serb aggression. The final agreement was a tribute to the skills of Dick Holbrooke and his negotiating team, to Warren Christopher, who at critical points was decisive in keeping the Bosnians on board and in closing the deal, to Tony Lake, who initially conceived and sold our peace initiative to our allies and who, with Holbrooke, pushed for the final talks to be held in the United States, to Sandy Berger, who chaired the deputies' committee meetings, which kept people throughout the national security operation informed of what was going on without allowing too much interference, and to Madeleine Albright, who strongly supported our aggressive posture in the United Nations. The choice of Dayton and Wright-Patterson Air Force Base was inspired and carefully chosen by the negotiating team. It was in the United States, but far enough away from Washington to discourage leaks, and the facilities permitted the kind of proximity talks that allowed Holbrooke and his team to hammer out the tough details. On November 22nd, after 21 days of isolation in Dayton, Holbrooke and his team came to the White House to receive my congratulations and discuss our next steps. We still had a big selling job on the Hill and with the American people, who, according to the latest polls, were proud of the peace agreement, but were still overwhelmingly opposed to sending U.S. troops to Bosnia. After Al Gore kicked off the meeting by saying that the military testimony to date had not been helpful, I told General Shalikashvili that I knew he supported our involvement in Bosnia, but that many of his subordinates remained ambivalent. Al and I had orchestrated our comments to emphasize that it was time for everybody in the government, not just the military, to get with the program. They have the desired effect. We already had strong support from some important members of Congress, especially Senators Lugar, Biden, and Lieberman. Others offered a more qualified endorsement, saying that they wanted a clear exit strategy. To add to their numbers, I began to invite members of Congress to the White House while sending Christopher, Perry, Shalikashvili, and Holbrooke to the Hill. Our challenge was complicated by the ongoing debate over the budget. The government was open for the time being, but the Republicans were threatening to shut it down again on December 15th. On November 27th, I took my case for U.S. involvement in Bosnia to the American people. Speaking from the Oval Office, I said that our diplomacy had produced the Dayton Accords and that our troops had been requested not to fight, but to help the parties implement the peace plan, which served our strategic interests and advanced our fundamental values. Because 25 other nations had already agreed to participate in a force of 60,000, only a third of the troops would be Americans. I pledged that they would go in with a clear, limited, achievable mission and would be well-trained and heavily armed to minimize the risk of casualties. After the address, I felt that I had made the strongest case I could for our responsibility to lead the forces of peace and freedom, and hoped that I had moved public opinion enough so that Congress would at least not try to stop me from sending in the troops. In addition to the arguments made in my speech, standing up for the Bosnians had another important benefit to the United States. It would demonstrate to Muslims the world over that the United States cared about them, respected Islam, and would support them if they rejected terror and embraced the possibilities of peace and reconciliation. On November 28th, after signing a bill to provide more than $5 billion for transportation projects that included my zero-tolerance drinking standard for drivers under 21, I left for a trip to the UK and Ireland to pursue another important peace initiative. Through all the activity in the Middle East and Bosnia and discussions over the budget, we had continued to work hard on Northern Ireland. On the eve of my trip, and with our urging, Prime Ministers Major and Bruton announced a breakthrough in the Irish peace process, a twin tracks initiative that provided for separate talks on arms decommissioning and the resolution of political issues. All parties, including Sinn Féin, would be invited to participate in talks overseen by an international panel which George Mitchell had agreed to chair. It was nice to fly into good news. On the 29th, I met with John Major and spoke to Parliament, where I thanked the British for their support of the Bosnian peace process and their willingness to play a major role in the NATO force. I commended Major for his pursuit of peace in Northern Ireland, quoting John Milton's lovely line, "Peace hath her victories, no less renowned than war." I also had my first meeting with the impressive young opposition leader, Tony Blair, who was in the process of reviving the Labour Party with an approach remarkably similar to what we had tried to do with the DLC. Meanwhile, back home, the Republicans had reversed their position on lobbying reform, and the House passed it without a dissenting vote, 421-0. The next day I flew to Belfast as the first American president ever to visit Northern Ireland. It was the beginning of two of the best days of my presidency. On the road in from the airport, there were people waving American flags and thanking me for working for peace. When I got to Belfast, I made a stop on the Shankill Road, the center of Protestant Unionism, where 10 people had been killed by an IRA bomb in 1993. The only thing most of the Protestants knew about me was the Adams visa. I wanted them to know that I was working for a peace that was fair to them, too. As I bought some flowers, apples, and oranges from a local shop, I talked to people and shook a few hands. In the morning, I spoke to the employees and other attendees at Mackey International, a textile machine manufacturer that employed both Catholics and Protestants. After being introduced by two children who wanted peace, one Protestant, the other Catholic, I asked the audience to listen to the kids. Only you can decide between division and unity, between hard lives and high hopes. The IRA's slogan was, "Our day will come." I urged the Irish to say to those who still clung to violence, "You are the past. Your day is over." Afterward, I stopped on the Falls Road, the heart of Belfast's Catholic community. I visited a bakery and began to shake hands with a quickly growing crowd of citizens. One of them was Jerry Adams. I told him that I was reading The Street, his book of short stories about the Falls, and that it gave me a better feel for what the Catholics had been through. It was our first public appearance together, and it signaled the importance of his commitment to the peace process. The enthusiastic crowd that quickly gathered was obviously pleased at the way things were going. In the afternoon, Hillary and I helicoptered to Derry, the most Catholic city in Northern Ireland, and John Hume's hometown. 25,000 cheering people filled the Guildhall Square and the streets leading to it. After Hume introduced me, I asked the crowd a simple question. Are you going to be someone who defines yourself in terms of what you are against or what you are for? Will you be someone who defines yourself in terms of who you aren't or who you are? The time has come for the peacemakers to triumph in Northern Ireland, and the United States will support them as they do. Hillary and I ended our day by returning to Belfast for the official lighting of the city's Christmas tree just outside City Hall before a crowd of about 50,000 people, which was fired up by the singing of Northern Ireland's own Van Morrison. "Oh, my mama told me there'll be days like this." We both spoke. She talked about the thousands of letters we had received from schoolchildren expressing their hopes for peace, and I quoted from one written by a 14-year-old girl from County Armagh. "Both sides have been hurt. Both sides must forgive." Then I ended my remarks by saying that for Jesus, whose birth we celebrated, no words more important than these: "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall inherit the earth." After the tree lighting, we attended a reception to which all the party leaders were invited, even the Reverend Ian Paisley, the fiery leader of the Democratic Unionist Party, came. Though he wouldn't shake hands with the Catholic leaders, he was only too happy to lecture me on the error of my ways. After a few minutes of his hectoring, I decided the Catholic leaders had gotten the better end of the deal. Hillary and I left the reception for our night at the Europa Hotel. On that first trip to Ireland, even our choice of lodging carried great symbolism. The Europa had been bombed on more than one occasion during the Troubles. Now it was safe for the President of the United States to stay there. It was the end of a perfect day, which even included some progress back home, as I signed the Department of Defense Appropriations Act, in which the congressional leaders had provided funding for our troop deployments in Bosnia. Dole and Gingrich had come through in exchange for a few billion dollars of extra spending that even the Pentagon said was unnecessary. The next morning we flew into Dublin, where the streets were lined with even bigger and more enthusiastic crowds than we had seen in the north. Hillary and I met with President Mary Robinson and Prime Minister Bruton, then went to a site outside the Bank of Ireland on the Trinity College Green, where I spoke to 100,000 people, waving Irish and American flags and cheering. By that time I had been joined by a large number of Irish-American congressmen, Secretary Dick Riley and Peace Corps Director Mark Geeran, the Irish-American mayors of Chicago, Pittsburgh, and Los Angeles, my very Irish stepfather Dick Kelly, and Secretary of Commerce Ron Brown, who had worked on our economic initiatives for Northern Ireland and kidded the rest of us about his being Black Irish. Once more, I urged the sea of people to set an example that would inspire the world. When the event was over, Hillary and I walked back into the majestic Bank of Ireland to meet Bono, his wife Allie, and other members of the Irish rock band U2. Bono was a big supporter of the peace process, and for my efforts he gave me a gift he knew I'd appreciate, a book of William Butler Yeats's plays inscribed by the author and by Bono, who wrote irreverently, "Bill Hillary Chelsea, this guy wrote a few good lyrics." Bono and Allie. The Irish aren't known for understatement, but Bono pulled it off. I left the College Green to address the Irish Parliament, reminding them that all of us had to do more to bring the tangible benefits of peace to ordinary Irish citizens. As Yeats said, "Too long a sacrifice can make a stone of the heart." Then I went to Cassidy's Pub, to which we had invited some of my distant relatives through my maternal grandfather, whose family had come from Fermanagh. Feeling full of my Irishness, I went from the pub to the American ambassador's residence, where Gene Kennedy Smith had arranged a brief meeting with the opposition leader Bertie Ahern, who would soon become prime minister and my newest partner for peace. I also met with Seamus Heaney, the Nobel Prize-winning poet, whom I had quoted in Derry the day before. The next morning, as I flew to see our troops in Germany, I had the feeling that my trip had shifted the psychological balance in Ireland. Until then, the advocates of peace had to argue their case to the skeptics, while their adversaries could just say no. After those 2 days, the burden had shifted to the opponents of peace to explain themselves. In Baumholder, General George Julwin, the NATO commander, briefed me on the military plan and assured me that the morale of the troops about to go to Bosnia was high. I met briefly with Helmut Kohl to thank him for his commitment to send 4,000 German soldiers, then flew to Spain to thank Prime Minister Felipe González, the current EU president, for Europe's support. I also acknowledged the leadership of NATO's new Secretary General, the former Spanish Foreign Minister, Javier Solana, an exceptionally able and delightful man who inspired the confidence of all his NATO leaders, no matter how large their egos. 3 days after I got home, I vetoed the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act because it went too far in limiting access to our courts to innocent investors victimized by securities fraud. Congress overrode my veto, but in 2001, when all the problems with Enron and WorldCom arose, I knew I had done the right thing. I also vetoed another Republican budget. They had made a few changes and tried to make it harder to veto by including their welfare reform bill, but it still cut health and education, raised taxes on the working poor, and relaxed rules that kept pension funds from being depleted for non-pension purposes, less than a year after the Democratic Congress had stabilized America's pension system. The next day, I submitted my own 7-year balanced budget plan. The Republicans panned it because it didn't accept all their estimates for revenues and expenses. We were $300 billion apart over 7 years, not an insurmountable difference in an annual budget of $1.6 trillion. I was confident we would eventually reach an agreement, though it might take another government shutdown to get us there. In mid-month, Shimon Peres came to see me for the first time as Prime Minister to reaffirm Israel's intention to turn over Gaza, Jericho, other major cities, and 450 villages in the West Bank to the Palestinians by Christmas, and to release at least another 1,000 Palestinian prisoners before the coming Israeli elections. We also discussed Syria, and I was encouraged enough by what Shimon said to call President Assad and ask him to see Warren Christopher about it. On the 14th, I flew to Paris for a day for the official signing of the agreement ending the Bosnian War. I met with the presidents of Bosnia, Croatia, and Serbia and went to a lunch with them hosted by Jacques Chirac at the Elysee Palace. Slobodan Milosevic was sitting across from me, and we talked for a good while. He was intelligent, articulate, and cordial, but he had the coldest look in his eyes I had ever seen. He was also paranoid, telling me he was sure Rabin's assassination was the result of betrayal by someone in his security service. Then he said that everyone knew that that's what happened to President Kennedy, too, but that we Americans have been successful in covering it up. After spending time with him, I was no longer surprised by his support of the murderous outrages of Bosnia, and I had the feeling that I would be at odds with him again before long. When I came home to the budget war, the Republicans shut down the government again, and it sure didn't feel as if Christmas was on the way, though seeing Chelsea dance in the Nutcracker brightened my mood considerably. This time the shutdown was somewhat less severe because about 500,000 federal employees deemed essential were allowed to work without pay until the government reopened. But benefits to veterans and poor kids still weren't being paid. It wasn't much of a Christmas present to the American people. On the 18th, I vetoed two more appropriations bills, one for the Department of the Interior, the other for the Department of Veterans Affairs and Housing and Urban Development. The next day, I signed the Lobbying Disclosure Act after the House Republicans reversed their opposition and vetoed a third appropriations bill for the Departments of Commerce, State, and Justice. This one was really something. It eliminated the COPS program in the face of clear evidence that more police on the beat reduced crime. It eliminated all the drug courts, like those that had been promoted by Janet Reno when she was the prosecuting attorney, which reduced crime and drug abuse. It eliminated the Commerce Department's Advanced Technology Program, which many Republican business people supported because it helped them become more competitive. And it severely cut funding for legal services for the poor and for foreign operations. By Christmas, I had felt for some time that if left to our own devices, Senator Dole and I could have resolved the budget impasse fairly easily. But Dole had to be careful. He was running for president, and Senator Phil Graham was running against him with Gingrich-like rhetoric in Republican primaries in which the electorate was well to the right of the country as a whole. After breaking for Christmas, I vetoed one more budget bill, the National Defense Authorization Act. This one was tough because the legislation included a military pay increase and a larger military housing allowance, both of which I strongly supported. Nevertheless, I felt I had to do it because the bill also mandated the complete deployment of a national missile defense system by 2003, well before a workable system could be developed or would be needed. Moreover, such action would violate our commitments under the ABM Treaty and jeopardize Russia's implementation of START 1 and its ratification of START 2. The bill also restricted the president's ability to commit troops in emergencies and interfered too much with important management prerogatives of the Defense Department, including its actions to redress the threat of weapons of mass destruction under the Nunn-Lugar program. No responsible president, Republican or Democrat, could have allowed that defense bill to become law. During the last 3 days of the year, our forces deployed to Bosnia, and I worked with the congressional leaders on the budget, including one seven-hour session. We made some progress, but broke for New Year's without agreement on the budget or on ending the shutdown. In the first session of the 104th Congress, the new Republican majority had enacted only 67 bills, as compared with 210 in the first year of the previous Congress. And only 6 of the 13 appropriations bills were law, 3 full months after the beginning of the fiscal year. As our family headed down to Hilton Head for Renaissance weekend, I wondered whether the American people's votes in the 94 elections had produced the results they wanted. And I thought about the last 2 emotionally draining, exhausting, jam-packed months, and the fact that the enormity of the events, Rabin's death, the Bosnian peace and the deployment of our troops, the progress in Northern Ireland, and the Herculean budget fight had done nothing to slow down the worker bees in Whitewater World. On November 29th, as I was making my way to Ireland, Senator D'Amato's committee called L. Jean Lewis to testify again about how her investigation of Madison Guaranty had been thwarted after I became president. During her appearance before Congressman Leach's committee the previous August, she had been so badly discredited by government documents and her own tape-recorded conversations with Resolution Trust Corporation attorney April Breslau that I was amazed D'Amato would call her back. On the other hand, hardly anybody knew of the problems with Lewis's testimony, and D'Amato received a lot of publicity, as Leach had, by simply leveling charges that were unsupported and were actually disproved by subsequent testimony. Lewis once again repeated her claim that her investigation was thwarted after I was elected. Richard Benveniste, the committee's minority counsel, confronted her with evidence that, contrary to her sworn deposition, she had tried repeatedly to push federal authorities to act on her referral of Hillary and me as material witnesses in Whitewater before the election, not after I became president, and had told an FBI agent that she was altering history by her actions. When Senator Paul Sarbanes read to Lewis from the 1992 letter of U.S. Attorney Chuck Banks saying that acting on her referral would constitute prosecutorial misconduct, then referred to a 1993 Justice Department appraisal of Lewis's inadequate knowledge of federal banking law, Lewis cried, slumped in her chair, and was led away, never to return. Less than a month later, in mid-December, the complete Whitewater story finally came out, when the RTC inquiry from Pillsbury, Madison, and Sutro was released. The report was written by Jay Stevens, who, like Chuck Banks, was a Republican former U.S. attorney whom I had replaced. It said, as had the preliminary report in June, that there were no grounds for a civil suit against us in Whitewater, much less any criminal action, and it recommended that the investigation be closed. This was what the New York Times and the Washington Post had wanted to know when they called for an independent counsel. I eagerly awaited their coverage. Immediately after the RTC report was released, the Post mentioned it in passing, in the 11th paragraph of a front-page story about an unrelated subpoena battle with Starr, and the New York Times didn't run a word. The Los Angeles Times, Chicago Tribune, and Washington Times ran an Associated Press story of about 400 words on the inside pages of their papers. The TV networks didn't cover the RTC report, though. ABC's Ted Koppel mentioned it on Nightline, then dismissed its importance because there were so many new questions. Whitewater wasn't about Whitewater anymore. It was about whatever Ken Starr could dig up on anybody in Arkansas or my administration. In the meantime, some Whitewater reporters were actually covering up evidence of our innocence. To be fair, a few journalists took note. Washington Post writer Howard Kurtz wrote an article pointing out the way the RTC report had been buried, and Lars Eric Nelson, a columnist for the New York Daily News, who had been a correspondent in the Soviet Union, wrote, "The secret verdict is in. There was nothing for the Clintons to hide. In a bizarre reversal of those Stalin-era trials in which innocent people were convicted in secret, the President and the First Lady have been publicly charged and secretly found innocent. I was genuinely confused by the mainstream press coverage of Whitewater. It seemed inconsistent with the more careful and balanced approach the press had taken on other issues, at least since the Republicans won Congress in 1994. One day after one of our budget meetings in October, I asked Senator Alan Simpson of Wyoming to stay a moment to talk. Simpson was a conservative Republican, but we had a pretty good relationship because of the friendship we had in common with his governor, Mike Sullivan. I asked Alan if he thought Hillary and I had done anything wrong in Whitewater. "Of course not," he said. "That's not what this is about. This is about making the public think you did something wrong. Anybody who looked at the evidence would see that you didn't." Simpson laughed at how willing the elitist press was to swallow anything negative about small rural places like Wyoming or Arkansas, and made an interesting observation. "You know, before you were elected, we Republicans believed the press was liberal. Now we have a more sophisticated view. They are liberal in a way. Most of them voted for you, but they think more like your right-wing critics do, and that's much more important." When I asked him to explain, he said, "Democrats like you and Sullivan get into government to help people. The right-wing extremists don't think government can do much to improve on human nature, but they do like power. So does the press. And since you're president, they both get power the same way, by hurting you." I appreciated Simpson's candor, and I thought about what he said for months. For a long time, whenever I was angry about the Whitewater press coverage, I would tell people about Simpson's analysis. When I finally just accepted his insight as accurate, it was liberating, and it cleared my head for the fight. Despite my anger over Whitewater and my puzzlement about what was behind the press coverage of it, I headed into 1996 feeling fairly optimistic. In 1995, we had helped save Mexico, gotten through Oklahoma City and increased the focus on terrorism, preserved and reformed affirmative action, ended the war in Bosnia, continued the Middle East peace process, and helped make progress in Northern Ireland. The economy had continued to improve, and so far, I was winning the budget fight with the Republicans, a battle that in the beginning seemed likely to doom my presidency. It could still lead to that, but as we headed into 1996, I was ready to see it through to the end. As I had told Dick Armey, I didn't want to be president if the price of doing so was meaner streets, weaker health care, fewer educational opportunities, dirtier air, and more poverty. I was betting that the American people didn't want those things either. Chapter 46. By January 2nd, we were back to the budget negotiations. Bob Dole wanted to make a deal to reopen the government, and after a couple of days, so did Newt Gingrich. In one of our budget meetings, the speaker admitted that in the beginning he had thought he could keep me from vetoing the GOP budget by threatening to shut the government down. In front of Dole, Armey, Daschle, Gephardt, Panetta, and Al Gore, he said frankly, "We made a mistake. We thought you would cave." Finally, on the 6th, with a severe blizzard covering Washington, the impasse was broken, as Congress sent me two more continuing resolutions that put all the federal employees back to work, though they still didn't restore all government services. I signed the CRs and sent the Congress my plan for a balanced budget in 7 years. The next week, I vetoed the Republican welfare reform bill because it did too little to move people from welfare to work and too much to hurt poor people and their children. The first time I vetoed the Republican welfare reform proposal, it had been a part of their budget. Now, a number of their budget cuts were simply put in a bill with the label welfare reform on it. Meanwhile, Donna Shalala and I had already gone far in reforming the welfare system on our own. We had given 50 separate waivers to 37 states to pursue initiatives that were pro-work and pro-family, 73% of America's welfare recipients were covered by these reforms, and the welfare rolls were dropping. As we headed into the State of the Union speech on the 23rd, we seemed to be making some progress on a budget agreement, so I used the address to reach out to the Republicans, rally the Democrats, and explain to the American people my position on both the budget debate and on the larger question that the budget battle presented: what was the proper role of government in the global information age? The basic theme of the speech was the era of big government is over, but we cannot go back to the time when our citizens were left to fend for themselves. This formulation reflected my philosophy of getting rid of yesterday's bureaucratic government while advocating a creative, future-oriented, empowering government. It also fairly described our economic and social policies and Al Gore's RIGO initiative. By then, my case was bolstered by the success of our economic policy. Nearly 8 million new jobs had been created since the inauguration, and a record number of new businesses had been started for 3 years in a row. U.S. automakers were even outselling their Japanese competitors in America for the first time since the 1970s. After offering again to work with the Congress to balance the budget in 7 years and pass welfare reform, I outlined a legislative agenda concerning families and children, education and health care, and crime and drugs. It emphasized programs that reflected basic American values and the idea of citizen empowerment. The V-CHIP, charter schools, public school choice, and school uniforms. I also named General Barry McCaffrey to be America's new drug czar. At the time, McCaffrey was Commander-in-Chief of the Southern Command, where he had worked to stop cocaine from being sent to America from Colombia and elsewhere. The most memorable moment of the evening came near the end of the speech, when, as usual, I introduced the people sitting in the First Lady's box with Hillary. The first person I mentioned was Richard Dean, a 49-year-old Vietnam veteran who had worked for the Social Security Administration for 22 years. When I told Congress that he had been in the Murrah Building in Oklahoma City when it was bombed, risked his life to re-enter the ruins 4 times, and save the lives of 3 women, Dean got a huge standing ovation from the entire Congress, with the Republicans leading the cheers. Then came the zinger. As the applause died down, I said, "But Richard Dean's story doesn't end there. This last November, he was forced out of his office when the government shut down. And the second time the government shut down, he continued helping Social Security recipients, but he was working without pay. On behalf of Richard Dean, I challenge all of you in this chamber, let's never, ever shut the federal government down again." This time the gleeful Democrats led the applause. The Republicans, knowing that they had been trapped, looked glum. I didn't think I had to worry about a third government shutdown. Its consequences now had a human, heroic face. Defining moments like that don't happen by accident. Every year we use the State of the Union as an organizing tool for the cabinet and staff to come up with new policy ideas, and then we work hard on how best to present them. On the day of the speech, we held several rehearsals in the movie theater located between the residence and the East Wing. The White House Communications Agency, which also recorded all my public statements, set up a teleprompter and a podium, and various staff members moved in and out through the day in an informal process managed by my communications director, Don Baer. We all worked together, listening to each sentence, imagining how it would be received in the Congress and in the country, and improving the language. We had defeated the philosophy behind the contract with America by winning the government shutdown debate. Now the speech offered an alternative philosophy of government, and through Richard Dean showed that federal employees were good people performing valuable services. It wasn't much different from what I'd been saying all along. But in the aftermath of the shutdown, millions of Americans heard and understood it for the first time. We began the year in foreign policy with Warren Christopher hosting talks between the Israelis and Syrians at Y River Plantation in Maryland. Then on January 12th, I flew overnight to the U.S. Air Force Base in Aviano, Italy, that had been the center of our NATO air operations over Bosnia, where I boarded one of our new C-17 transport planes for the flight to Tazar Air Base in Hungary, from which our troops were deploying into Bosnia. I had fought in 1993 to keep the C-17 from being eliminated in the defense downsizing. It was an amazing plane with remarkable cargo capacity and the ability to operate in difficult conditions. The Bosnian mission was using 12 C-17s, and I had to fly one into Tuzla. The regular Air Force One, a Boeing 747, was too big. After meeting with Hungarian President Arpad Gans and seeing our troops in Tazar, I flew to Tuzla in northeastern Bosnia, the area for which the United States was responsible. In less than a month, and despite terrible weather, 7,000 of our troops and more than 2,000 armored vehicles had crossed the flooded Sava River to reach their duty stations. They had turned an airfield with no lights or navigational equipment into one that was open for business around the clock. I thanked the troops and personally delivered a birthday present to a colonel whose wife had charged me with the duty when I stopped in Aviano. I met with President Izetbegovic, then flew to Zagreb, Croatia, to meet President Tudjman. Both of them were satisfied with the implementation of the peace agreement so far and very glad U.S. troops were part of it. By the time I got back to Washington, it had been a long day, but an important one. Our troops were involved in NATO's first deployment beyond its members' borders. They were working with soldiers of their Cold War adversaries, Russia, Poland, the Czech Republic, Hungary, and the Baltic states. Their mission was pivotal to creating a united Europe, yet it was being criticized in Congress and in coffee shops across America. The troops were at least entitled to know why they were in Bosnia and how strongly I supported them. 2 weeks later, the Cold War continued to fade into history as the Senate ratified the START II Treaty, which President Bush had negotiated and submitted to the Senate 3 years earlier, just before he left office. Together with the START I Treaty, which we put into force in December 1994, START II would eliminate two-thirds of the nuclear arsenals the United States and the former Soviet Union had maintained at the height of the Cold War, including the most destabilizing nuclear weapons, the multiple warhead intercontinental ballistic missiles. Along with START I and II, we had signed an agreement to freeze North Korea's nuclear program, had led the effort to make the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty permanent, and were working to safeguard and ultimately dismantle nuclear weapons and materials under the Nunn-Lugar program. In congratulating the Senate on START II, I asked them to continue making America more secure by passing the Chemical Weapons Convention and my anti-terrorism legislation. On January 30th, Prime Minister Viktor Chernomyrdin of Russia came to the White House for his sixth meeting with Al Gore. After they finished their commission business, Chernomyrdin came to see me to brief me on events in Russia and Yeltsin's prospects for re-election. Just before our meeting, I spoke to President Süleyman Demirel and Prime Minister Tansu Çiller of Turkey. They told me that Turkey and Greece were on the brink of military confrontation and implored me to intervene to stop it. They were about to go to war over two tiny Aegean islets called Imea by the Greeks and Kardak by the Turks. Both countries claimed the islets, but Greece apparently had acquired them in a treaty with Italy in 1947. Turkey denied the validity of the Greek claim. There were no people living there, though Turks often sailed to the larger islet for picnics. The crisis was triggered when some Turkish journalists had torn down a Greek flag and put up a Turkish one. It was unthinkable that two great countries with a real dispute over Cyprus would actually go to war over 10 acres of rock islets inhabited by only a couple of dozen sheep, but I could tell that Çiller was genuinely afraid it could happen. I interrupted the Chernomyrdin meeting to get briefed, then placed a series of calls first to Greek Prime Minister Konstantinos Tsimitas, then Demirel and Chiller again. After all the talk back and forth, the two sides agreed to hold their fire, and Dick Holbrook, who was already working on Cyprus, stayed up all night to get the parties to agree to resolve the problem through diplomacy. I couldn't help laughing to myself at the thought that whether or not I succeeded in making peace in the Middle East, Bosnia, or Northern Ireland, at least I had saved some Aegean sheep. Just when I thought things couldn't get any weirder in Whitewater World, they did. On January 4th, Carolyn Huber found copies of Hillary's records for work the Rose firm had done for Madison Guaranty in 1985 and 1986. Carolyn had been our assistant at the governor's mansion and had come to Washington to help us with our personal papers and correspondence. She had already assisted David Kendall in turning over 50,000 pages of documents to the independent counsel's office, but for some reason this copy of the billing records wasn't among them. Carolyn found it in a box she had moved to her office from the third-floor residence storage area the previous August. Apparently the copy had been made in the 1992 campaign. It had Vince Foster's notes on it because he was handling press questions for the Rose firm at the time. On the surface, it must have looked suspicious. Why were the records turning up after all this time? If you had seen the disordered array of papers we brought up from Arkansas, you wouldn't have been surprised. I'm amazed we found as much material as we did in a timely fashion. At any rate, Hillary was glad the records had been found. They proved her contention that she had done only a modest amount of work for Madison Guaranty. In a few weeks, the RTC would issue a report saying just that. But that's not how the Independent Counsel, Congressional Republicans, and the Whitewater Reporters played it. In his New York Times column, William Safire called Hillary a congenital liar. Carolyn Huber was called up to Congress to testify before Al D'Amato's committee on January 18th. And on the 26th, Kenneth Starr hauled Hillary before the grand jury for 4 hours of questioning. Starr's summons was a cheap, sleazy publicity stunt. We had turned the records over voluntarily as soon as we found them, and they proved the truth of Hillary's account. If Starr had more questions, he could have come to the White House to ask them, as he had done 3 times before, rather than make her the first lady to appear before a grand jury. In 1992, President Bush's White House counsel, Boyden Gray, had withheld his boss's diary for more than a year until after the election in direct violation of a subpoena from the Iran-Contra prosecutor. No one put Gray or Bush before a grand jury, and the press uproar was nowhere near as great. I was more troubled by the attacks on Hillary than on those directed at me. Because I was helpless to stop them, all I could do was stand by her, telling the press that America would be a better place if everybody in this country had the character my wife has. Hillary and I explained to Chelsea what was going on. She didn't like it, but seemed to take it in stride. She knew her mother a lot better than her assailants did. Still, it was wearying on all of us. I had been struggling for months to keep my anger from interfering with my work as I dealt with the budget fight, Bosnia, Northern Ireland, and Rabin's death. But it had been very hard. Now I was anxious for Hillary and Chelsea as well. I was also concerned about all the other people being pulled into the congressional hearings and into Starr's net, who were being hurt emotionally and financially. 5 days after the billing records were turned over, Hillary was scheduled to do an interview with Barbara Walters so that she could discuss her new book, It Takes a Village. Instead, the interview turned into a session on the billing records. It Takes a Village became a bestseller anyway, as Hillary bravely set out from Washington on a book tour across the country and found legions of friendly and supportive Americans who cared more about what she had to say about improving children's lives than about what Ken Starr, Al D'Amato, William Safire, and their friends had to say about her. Those boys certainly seemed to get a big kick out of beating up on Hillary. My only consolation was the sure knowledge, rooted in 25 years of close observation, that she was a lot tougher than they would ever be. Some guys don't like that in a woman, but it was one of the reasons I loved her. In early February, as the presidential campaign kicked into high gear, I returned to New Hampshire to highlight both the positive impact of my policies there and my commitment not to forget about the state after I took office. Although I had no primary opponent, I wanted to carry New Hampshire in November, and I needed to deal with the one issue I thought could keep me from doing it, guns. On Saturday morning, I went to a diner in Manchester full of men who were deer hunters and NRA members. In impromptu remarks, I told them that I knew that they had defeated their Democratic Congressman Dick Sweat in 1994 because he voted for the Brady Bill and the assault weapons ban. Several of them nodded in agreement. Those hunters were good men who had been frightened by the NRA. I thought they could be stampeded again in 1996, only if no one presented them with the other side of the argument in language they could understand. So I gave it my best shot. I know the NRA told you to defeat Congressman Sweat. Now, if you missed a day, or even an hour in the deer woods because of the Brady Bill or the assault weapons ban, I want you to vote against me too, because I asked him to support those bills. On the other hand, if you didn't, then they didn't tell you the truth and you need to get even. A few days later at the Library of Congress, I signed the Telecommunications Act, a sweeping overhaul of the laws affecting an industry that was already one-sixth of our economy. The act increased competition, innovation, and access to what Al Gore had dubbed the information superhighway. There had been months of sparring over complex economic issues, with the Republicans favoring greater concentration of ownership in media and telecommunications markets, and the White House and Democrats supporting greater competition, especially in local and long-distance telephone service. With Al Gore taking the lead for the White House and Speaker Gingrich in his positive entrepreneurial mode, we reached what I thought was a fair compromise, and in the end, the bill passed almost unanimously. It also contained a requirement that new television sets include the V-chip, which I had first endorsed at the Gore's annual family conference, to allow parents to control their children's access to programs. By the end of the month, executives from most of the television networks would agree to have a rating system for their programs in place by 1997. Even more important, the act mandated discounted internet access rates for schools, libraries, and hospitals. The so-called E-rate would eventually save public entities about $2 billion a year. The next day, the bloom came off the Irish rose as Jerry Adams called to tell me the IRA had ended its ceasefire, allegedly because of foot-dragging by John Major and the Unionists, including their insistence on IRA arms decommissioning in return for Sinn Féin's participation in the political life of Northern Ireland. Later that day, a bomb exploded at Canary Wharf in London. The IRA would keep it up for more than a year, at great cost to themselves. While they killed two soldiers and two civilians and injured many others, they suffered the deaths of two IRA operatives, the breakup of their bombing team in Britain, and the arrest of numerous IRA operatives in Northern Ireland. By the end of the month, peace vigils were being held all over Northern Ireland to demonstrate the continuing support of ordinary citizens for peace. John Major and John Bruton said they would resume talks with Sinn Féin if the IRA reinstated its ceasefire. With John Hume's support, the White House decided to maintain contact with Adams, waiting for the moment when the march toward peace could resume. The peace process in the Middle East was also threatened in late February, as two Hamas bombs killed 26 people. With elections coming up in Israel, I assumed Hamas was trying to defeat Prime Minister Peres and provoke the Israelis to elect a hardline government that would not make peace with the PLO. We pushed Arafat to do more to prevent terrorist acts. As I had told him when we signed the original agreement back in 1993, he could never be the most militant Palestinian again, and if he tried to keep one foot in the peace camp and the other on the terrorist side, he would eventually be undone. We also had trouble closer to home when Cuba shot down two civilian planes flown by the anti-Castro group Brothers to the Rescue, killing four men. Castro hated the group and the leaflets critical of him that it had dropped over Havana in the past. Cuba claimed the planes were shot in its airspace. They weren't. But even if they had been, the downing still would have violated international law. I suspended charter flights to Cuba, restricted travel by Cuban officials in the United States, expanded the reach of Radio Martí, which beamed pro-democracy messages into Cuba, and asked Congress to authorize compensation out of Cuba's blocked assets in the United States to the families of the men who were killed. Madeleine Albright asked the United Nations to impose sanctions and went to Miami to deliver a fiery speech to the Cuban-American community, telling them that the shootdown reflected cowardice, not cojones. Her macho remarks made her a heroine among South Florida's Cubans. I also committed to signing a version of the Helms-Burton Bill, which stiffened the embargo against Cuba and restricted the president's authority to lift it without congressional approval. Supporting the bill was good election year politics in Florida, but it undermined whatever chance I might have if I won a second term to lift the embargo in return for positive changes within Cuba. It almost appeared that Castro was trying to force us to maintain the embargo as an excuse for the economic failures of his regime. If that wasn't the objective, then Cuba had made a colossal error. I later received word from Castro, indirectly of course, that the shootdown was a mistake. Apparently he had issued earlier orders to fire on any aircraft that violated Cuban airspace, and had failed to withdraw them when the Cubans knew the Brothers to the Rescue planes were coming. In the last week of the month, after visiting areas devastated by recent flooding in Washington, Oregon, Idaho, and Pennsylvania, I met with the new Japanese Prime Minister in Santa Monica, California. Ryutaro Hashimoto had been Mickey Cantor's counterpart before becoming the head of the Japanese government. An avid practitioner of kendo, a Japanese martial art, Hashimoto was a tough, intelligent man who enjoyed combat of all kinds. But he was also a leader with whom we could work. He and Cantor had concluded 20 trade agreements, our exports to Japan were up 80%, and our bilateral trade deficit had declined for 3 years in a row. The month ended on a high note as Hillary and I celebrated Chelsea's 16th birthday by taking her to see Les Miserables at the National Theater, then hosting a busload of her friends for a weekend at Camp David. We liked all of Chelsea's friends, and we loved seeing them shooting at one another with paintball guns in the woods, bowling and playing other games, and generally being kids as their high school years were drawing to a close. The best part of the weekend for me was giving Chelsea a driving lesson around the Camp David compound. I missed driving and wanted Chelsea to enjoy it and do it safely and well. The Middle East peace process was shaken again in the first weeks of March when on successive days a new round of Hamas bombs in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv killed more than 30 people and wounded many more. Among the dead were children, a Palestinian nurse who lived and worked among her Jewish friends, and two young American women. I met with their families in New Jersey and was deeply moved by their steadfast commitment to peace as the only way to prevent more children from being killed in the future. In a televised address to the people of Israel, I stated the obvious, that the terrorist acts were aimed not just at killing innocent people, but at killing the growing hope for peace in the Middle East. On March 12th, Jordan's King Hussein flew on Air Force One with me to a summit of peacemakers hosted by President Mubarak in Sharm el-Sheikh, a beautiful resort on the Red Sea favored by European scuba diving enthusiasts. Hussein had come to see me at the White House a few days earlier to condemn the Hamas bombings and was determined to rally the Arab world to the cause of peace. I really enjoyed the long flight with him. We had always gotten along well, but we had become closer friends and allies in the aftermath of Rabin's assassination. Leaders of 29 nations from the Arab world, Europe, Asia, and North America, including Boris Yeltsin and UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali, joined Peres and Arafat at Sharm el-Sheikh. President Mubarak and I co-chaired the meeting. We and our staffs had worked day and night to ensure that we would come out of the conference with a clear and concrete commitment to fighting terror and preserving the peace process. For the first time, the Arab world stood with Israel in condemning terror and promising to work against it. The united front was essential to give Peres the support necessary to keep the peace process going and to reopen Gaza, so that the thousands of Palestinians who lived there but had jobs in Israel could go back to work. It was also necessary to give Arafat the backing to make an all-out effort against the terrorists, without which Israeli support for peace would collapse. On the 13th, I flew to Tel Aviv to discuss specific steps the United States could take to help the Israeli military and police. In a meeting with Prime Minister Peres and his cabinet, I pledged $100 million in support and asked Warren Christopher and CIA Director John Deutsch to stay in Israel to accelerate the implementation of our joint efforts. In the press conference with Peres after our meeting, I acknowledged the difficulty of providing complete protection from young men who have bought some apocalyptic version of Islam and politics that causes them to strap their bodies with bombs in order to commit suicide and kill innocent children. But I said we could improve our capacity to prevent such events and to break up the networks of money and national support that made them possible. I also used the occasion to urge congressional action on the anti-terrorism legislation that had been held up for more than a year. After the press conference and a question and answer session with young Israeli students in Tel Aviv, I met with the Likud party leader Benjamin Netanyahu. The Hamas bombings had made a Likud victory in the election more likely. I wanted Netanyahu to know that if he won, I would be his partner in the fight against terror. But I also wanted him to stick with the peace process. I couldn't go home without making the trip to Mount Herzl to visit Rabin's grave. I knelt, said a prayer, and following Jewish custom, placed a small stone on Yitzhak's marble marker. I also took another small rock from the ground around the grave home with me as a reminder of my friend and the job he had left me to do. While I was preoccupied with the trouble in the Middle East, China roiled the waters of the Taiwan Strait by test-firing three missiles close to Taiwan in an apparent attempt to discourage the Taiwanese politicians from pushing for independence in the election campaign then underway. Ever since President Carter normalized relations with mainland China, the United States had followed a consistent policy of recognizing one China while continuing to have good relations with Taiwan and saying that the two sides should resolve their differences peacefully. We had never said whether we would or wouldn't come to the defense of Taiwan if it were attacked. It seemed to me that the Middle East and Taiwan were polar opposite foreign policy problems. If nothing was done by political leaders in the Middle East, things would get worse. By contrast, I thought if the politicians in China and Taiwan didn't do anything foolish, the problem would resolve itself over time. Taiwan was an economic powerhouse that had moved from dictatorship to democracy. It wanted no part of the mainland's bureaucratic communism. On the other hand, Taiwanese business people were investing heavily in China, and there was travel back and forth. China liked the Taiwanese investment, but could not agree to give up its claim to sovereignty over the island. Finding the right balance between economic pragmatism and aggressive nationalism was a constant challenge for China's leaders, especially during election season in Taiwan. I thought China had gone too far with the missile tests, and quickly but without fanfare, I ordered a carrier group from the U.S. Navy's Pacific Fleet to sail to the Taiwan Strait. The crisis passed. After a rocky start in February, Bob Dole won all the Republican primaries in March, wrapping up his party's nomination with a late-month victory in California. Even though Senator Phil Graham, who ran to the right of Dole, would have been easier to beat, I was pulling for Dole. No election is a sure thing, and if I lost, I believe the country would be in more solid and more moderate hands with him. While Dole was moving toward the nomination, I campaigned in several states, including an event in Maryland with General McCaffrey and Jesse Jackson, to highlight our efforts to stem teen drug use and to stop at Harman International, a manufacturer of premier speakers in Northridge, California, to announce that the economy had produced 8.4 million jobs in just over 3 years since I took office. I had promised 8 million in 4 years. Middle-class incomes were also beginning to rise. In the last 2 years, two-thirds of the new jobs created were in industries that paid above the minimum wage. During the course of the month, we didn't reach agreement on the appropriations bills still outstanding, so I signed three more CRs and sent my budget for the next fiscal year up to Capitol Hill. Meanwhile, the House continued to follow the NRA. Voting to repeal the assault weapons ban and to delete from the anti-terrorism legislation sections the gun lobby opposed. At the end of the month, I initiated an effort to accelerate the approval of anti-cancer drugs by the Food and Drug Administration. Al Gore, Donna Shalala, and FDA Administrator David Kessler had worked to cut the average approval process for new drugs from 33 months in 1987 to just under a year in 1994. The latest approval for an AIDS drug was issued in just 42 days. It was important for the FDA to determine how drugs would affect the body before they were approved, but the process should be as speedy as safety permitted. Lives were riding on it. Finally, on March 29th, 8 months after Bob Rubin and I first requested it, I signed a bill to increase the debt limit. The Damocles sword of default was no longer hanging over our budget negotiations. On April 3rd, with springtime in full bloom in Washington, I was working in the Oval Office when I received word that the Air Force jet carrying Ron Brown and a U.S. trade and investment delegation he had organized to increase the economic benefits of peace to the Balkans had flown off course in bad weather and crashed into St. John's Mountain near Dubrovnik, Croatia.
End of Disc 10.